Part 4. A Judge Becomes a Justice. Introduction. William Jefferson Clinton took office in early January 1993, the first Democrat since the defeat of Jimmy Carter in 1980. Like all presidents, he hoped to appoint one or more justices to the U.S. Supreme Court, especially as it had been decades since a Democrat had done so. When Justice Byron White announced in March that he would retire at the end of the court's term in June, the new president got his wish, and the search for the right candidate began. President Carter had appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in the waning months of his presidency. Now, Judge Ginsburg was on President Clinton's list of possible candidates for the Supreme Court. The almost three-month-long selection process was meandering and tumultuous, involving numerous lead candidates along the way. Among them were New York Governor Mario Cuomo, Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, and Federal Judge Stephen Breyer. Even though Judge Ginsburg's name was on the initial lists, she was not one of the top finalists until very late in the process. In the words of one White House official, her pick was only possible because of all the dominoes that had fallen before it. As Justice Ginsburg somewhat humorously and modestly put it years later, I was the last one left standing. The final decision wasn't made by the president until Sunday, June 13th, after a pivotal meeting at the White House between President Clinton and Judge Ginsburg. The Friday before, she was attending the D.C. Circuit Judicial Conference at the Tidewater Inn in Maryland, with plans to return to D.C. later that day and then fly to Vermont in the evening to attend a wedding. While still at the Judicial Conference, Judge Ginsburg received a call from Joel Klein, a highly regarded attorney who was working closely with the White House on the nomination process. He advised her to stand by for a later call, in which she might be asked to cancel her Vermont plans so that she would be available for a meeting with the president. On her return to D.C., she received another call from Klein, who told her, "It's okay to go to Vermont." The Ginsburgs proceeded to Vermont Friday night and had barely checked into their hotel room when White House counsel Bernard Nussbaum called, asking Judge Ginsburg to return to Washington as quickly as possible to meet the president. Ruth and Marty stayed for the wedding Saturday evening and flew back to D.C. Sunday morning. Ruth Ginsburg did not like to get up early, especially on the weekend, but she had no problem waking up early that Sunday morning to catch the first plane back to D.C. It was a beautiful, sunny day when the Ginsburgs arrived back at their home in Watergate South to prepare for the arrival of the White House vetting team and for Judge Ginsburg's meeting with President Clinton at the White House. Nussbaum and the vetting team arrived and prepared to start work. But first, Marty, an excellent chef, made lunch for them. He recalled serving a very well-known, uncomplicated Tuscan dish of cannellini beans, canned tuna fish, lemon juice, and I make it a little bit differently, but for the better. Fortunately, there were scallions in the house, and that's all you need, scallions and parsley with that, and a few cans, and everyone is amazed. If the vetters were amazed at the food, they were also quite impressed by how easy the Ginsburgs made the vetting process. "I have vetted 100 judges," then Associate White House Counsel Ron Klain told us, "and I never met anyone who was as well prepared as Ruth and Marty. Marty had everything. I mean, like, oh, would you like to see Ruth's tax returns back to the year 1946? Here's a list of every person who ever worked in her household and her domestic help, their social security numbers, their immigration papers. If I ever want to get on the Supreme Court, I need to marry someone like Marty." The Ginsburgs were amused that everyone assumed tax lawyer Marty was responsible for the thorough and organized records, when in fact it had been Ruth who maintained all of the household financial records over the years. While Marty and the vetting team pored over the Ginsburgs' meticulously kept records and dined on Marty's gourmet fare, Bernie Nussbaum and Judge Ginsburg headed to the White House to meet the president. To avoid press attention, the president had instructed Nussbaum to avoid the Oval Office and instead usher Judge Ginsburg into the White House through the back door and up into the family's private quarters on the second floor to await his arrival. We had all this leaking about the process and the candidates, President Clinton told us. I said, surely to goodness we can get her in on Sunday through the back door without anybody knowing about it. Most of the people that I believe are doing all this leaking, they don't work here on Sunday. Just bring her to the back door. More than two decades later, President Clinton remembered how Judge Ginsburg reacted to her cloak and dagger entrance to the White House. It tickled her that I had to smuggle her into the White House. She liked that, and I liked the fact that she had a sense of humor. I think it's very hard to endure over the long run and have a positive impact on the court that goes beyond the writing of your opinions if you don't have a sense of humor. Judge Ginsburg, who had returned from Vermont wearing slacks and a top and jacket, wanted to change into more formal clothes before heading to the White House, but Nussbaum had assured her there was no need. The president, he said, was coming straight from the golf course and would be dressed casually. But when the president walked in, he was dressed up in a suit and tie. Instead of playing golf, he had decided to go to church that morning and had donned his Sunday best. Ginsburg leaned over and whispered, "Bernie, what have you done to me?" Bernie replied, "I don't know what happened, some change in plans, but don't worry, you look very nice." The president and the judge met for over an hour. Ginsburg felt there was an immediate and strong rapport. Bill Clinton, whatever his problems were, talks comfortably to women. They talked about gender equality and church-state cases. The judge was impressed with the president's knowledge of Supreme Court cases and his grasp of constitutional doctrine. She talked with him about her childhood and her work as a women's rights litigator. They discussed the 1957 integration of Little Rock Central High School and how the 9 black students enrolled in the school were prevented from entering until President Eisenhower called up the National Guard to escort them in. The judge told the president how moved she had been when she visited Central High in 1990 while in Little Rock to give a talk at the University of Arkansas Law School. She reminded the president that they had in fact met on that very occasion. Then Governor Clinton, his wife Hillary Rodham Clinton, then head of the American Bar Association Commission on Women, arrived late for Judge Ginsburg's talk, and the three chatted briefly afterwards. Justice Ginsburg later recounted to us that she had called Marty that evening. When she told him that the governor and his wife had come to hear her speak, Marty, ever the comedian, replied, "Well, what else is there to do at night in Little Rock?" Ruth Ginsburg left the White House feeling good about her meeting with Bill Clinton. "I really liked him," she told herself, "and I think he liked me." President Clinton did like Judge Ginsburg. As President Clinton reflected during our interview with him, "We had a wonderful visit, and it sort of sealed the deal for me. I felt strongly enough that I trusted myself the way I felt about her. I wanted to go forward." Every judge, he told us, needs to have both the intellectual capacity to deal with the incredible variety and complexity of the issues and an instinctive and immediate understanding of the human implications of the decisions being made. And I just talked to her about her life and her experience and her family and her work and her judging. And that's really what I wanted to know. You know, that it wasn't just stuff she had written. It was way more than just an intellectual concern of hers. She got the actual human impact of these decisions. Bernie Nussbaum wanted the president to call Judge Ginsburg immediately, but the president was having some friends over to watch the third game in the NBA Finals between the Chicago Bulls and the Phoenix Suns. Nussbaum called Ginsburg and told her, "Don't go to sleep, you might get a call." The basketball game turned out to be one of the longest games in NBA history. 3 hours and 20 minutes. The Suns beat the Bulls 129-121 in triple overtime. Ruth, not a basketball fan, spent the evening at home with Marty, waiting for the phone to ring. When the basketball game finally ended at 11:30 p.m., President Clinton said goodnight to his guests and went down to the White House kitchen to call Judge Ginsburg. He tried phoning her through the White House switchboard, but there was a problem with the connection. On his first try, he said, "Hello, hello," but Ginsburg couldn't hear him. Second time, he got through briefly and said, "Did I wake you up?" Again, though, there was a problem with the connection. "Hang up," the president said. "I'll call you right back." This time, President Clinton dialed the number himself and finally got a good connection. If I'm going to propose, he joked, we might as well have a good line. I'm going to ask you to accept this position tomorrow, he said. I feel really good about this. The president went on to tell Ginsburg why he chose her, talked about her work on behalf of women's rights, her outstanding record on the bench, and his belief that as an independent, mainstream, progressive jurist, she could be a real leader on the court. He also joked about how the selection process bore some resemblance to the suspenseful marathon basketball game he had just watched. The president ended with the call, telling his nominee to be at the Rose Garden early the next day with acceptance remarks. You have a lot of character, he said. Just speak from your heart and mind tomorrow. So I knew, she recalled, that as high as I was with this great news, I had to settle down and write some remarks that I could deliver the next day. But the first order of business after hanging up the phone was a celebratory hug and a kiss from Marty.